Hello. This podcast is available unedited and ad-free at patreon.com/HamiltonMorris. Each month, I release 3 to 4 new podcasts, and it was Patreon exclusive until recently. Many people contacted me and said they wanted me to figure out a way to make it freely available, and so I decided to accept sponsorship from a few of my friends. One of them is David Rentlin, the founder of a company called Lucy Nicotine. They make nicotine gum, nicotine pouches, nicotine lozenges, some of which are made with synthetic nicotine, which I think is pretty cool. Now, if you don't already use nicotine, I recommend that you don't start. It's habit forming. But if you already do use nicotine products, and especially if you smoke tobacco cigarettes, I can say that this is a cleaner product. And it's also a product that I use personally. If you go to lucy.co and use the code Hamilton, you get 20% off your purchase. This podcast is also brought to you by MindCure, a Canadian life sciences company producing synthetic ibogaine that is also engaged in psychedelic research with MDMA. They're doing some cool work, and I'm on their board of advisors. Lastly, this podcast is brought to you by Top Tree Herbs, an herbal tea company founded by my friend and pharmacopoeia producer, Soren Shade. This is not a traditional sponsorship in that I'm not receiving any money from them, but Soren is actually a producer on this podcast. They grow their own kratom domestically in Appalachia in a greenhouse, which is very beautiful, and they source leaves internationally, do third-party testing. I've been to the lab where they do the testing. They test for heavy metals and other adulterants, and it's ethically sourced in tea bag form. You can find their teas at toptreeherbs.com. This is one of these papers that I have just been fascinated by for a really long time. It was published in 1956 by two microbiologists named Doris Keller and Wayne Umbright. And they were both employed by Merck Pharmaceuticals. They were not psychedelic experts. They only have 2 papers on psychedelics. And the name of this paper is Permanent Alteration of Behavior in Mice by Chemical and Psychological Means. And there's a lot packed into this very short 2-page paper. One, you can make some kind of political extrapolations about what they were trying to do. You know, this was at a time when there was just starting to be a lot of interest in the possibility that LSD could be used as a model for psychosis, specifically schizophrenia. One of the big discrepancies between the psychedelic experience and the schizophrenic experience is that the psychedelic experience is transient and reversible in most instances, and the schizophrenic experience is not reversible in most instances. And so the question emerges, okay, if this is a pharmacological model for schizophrenia, why is it transient and can that be changed? Can this alteration be made permanent? So that's what I see as a sort of implicit goal that is not stated in this article. Even more interesting than that is the means they used to achieve this permanent behavioral alteration, which was done via the co-administration of LSD, we're all familiar with LSD, and indole. So indole is not usually discussed as a psychoactive or even a bioactive substance outside of the context of microbiology. I mean, it is bioactive, but it's not used therapeutically as a drug. It's actually, because it's ubiquitous, it's somewhat hard to even research the bioactivity of indole. I don't know anyone that has ever, taken 100 milligrams of indole to see what happens, and I wouldn't recommend that anyone do that. So just the very idea of using indole was a little bit unusual, but they co-administered LSD and indole, and they found a permanent behavioral alteration, or one that lasted many months in mice, that was manifested in terms of a head twitch. And again, what I also find very fascinating about this paper is the scientific method, if executed correctly, can elucidate truths that the researchers weren't even aware of. If you are carefully observing reality and you are conducting your experiments in a rigorous fashion, it might be the case that you discover something, don't even realize it, and then subsequent researchers find that the most important aspect of your experiment was something that you weren't even aware of. So in this case, they are focused on this permanent behavioral alteration, this interaction between LSD and indole, and the fact that they are measuring this alteration in terms of a head twitch response is almost a secondary component to this paper. But in the, you know, half century plus since this publication, the head twitch response has been the subject of thousands of scientific articles. Every month you will find new articles about head twitch. And you might be thinking, okay, this is a really obscure subject to spend an hour talking about. I would say it is not that obscure. And I would say that, you know, for people that are just getting interested in psychedelic research, if you go read some of the contemporary scientific articles, sometimes you'll encounter something like the head twitch response called the HTR. And you might think, well, what is that? And I think a really good way to learn about these things is to trace them back to their origins, to see where they started and learn from there, because it's often the case that their origins are very strange, and it makes an interesting story that can help you understand how these things became commonplace items in scientific research. So I'm actually going to upload to my YouTube channel a high-speed video of a mouse being injected with a 3 mg/kg dose of DPT, which shows a kind of textbook head twitch response. So that will allow people to visualize exactly what it is that Jason and I are talking about. And I'm going to attach a few papers as well that will contextualize some of the information that we're discussing. But what I would say is, you know, even if this seems impossibly obscure to you, or this seems like, you know, this is not relevant to your interest in psychedelics, have a listen. This is a very important way of measuring the activity of psychedelics in rodents. And you might say, well, this is all kind of a symptom of our deeply sick scientific research tactics, where we, instead of using human subjects, we use animal experimentation. And maybe that's true. But, you know, with any psychoactive drug, you do want to look for some kind of an animal model. And with sedatives, anesthetics, analgesics, stimulants, it's pretty easy to find an animal model that has a lot of translational value in humans. But with drugs that act more directly on the psychological components of human consciousness, it becomes more nuanced, right? You know, what is it? How do you find a model for psychedelics or dissociatives or cannabinoids or things like that? So this is the sort of question that the HTR is employed to answer, because it is thought to be a very strong behavioral correlate for 5-HT2A agonism. So this is a discussion with my good friend, Dr. Jason Wallach. We are talking about the first paper from 1956 on the HTR, and I hope you enjoy it.
I imagine you've had the chance to take a look at the original HTR paper.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So it's pretty crazy.
It's very interesting, yeah.
Even looking up indole and trying to research its pharmacological activity, it's talked about as a chemical class, the indoles, more than it is as a bioactive compound outside of, you know, coal tar research and bacterial signaling, which is actually relevant here because the two authors of the HTR paper were both not chemists or even pharmacologists, but microbiologists.
I had the same issue. Like, I tried to look a little bit, everything that came, it's such a ubiquitous term in many drug classes that just like the abundance of literature was difficult to weed through. I found a couple papers looking at it's like metabolism in rodents. They didn't report any behavioral effects that I saw, and the doses that were given were orders of magnitude above this study. But no, I didn't find much else. And I was looking at any cases of indole overdose or intoxication in any species, but didn't find much. I mean, the dose is fairly low.
Oh, yeah, it's really low. It's almost as low as the dose of LSD that they use.
And so I don't... I mean, there's a couple, like, weird... I mean, so clearly the basic head twitch response was replicated, right? Plenty of people have seen that then, but I have not seen anyone replicate the so-called permanency of the indole effect. The other thing they say that's interesting, where there is some evidence for this, that social isolation also caused a head twitch response and had some permanency. I have not seen the permanency reported by other people, but there's definitely evidence that head twitch is at least like influenced by animals being caged alone or in a group. And I know like even Adam Halberstadt has talked about that in some of his work, like if you don't want to keep the animals alone. I don't know if it's based off of this study, but there's a handful that I've seen.
And it's also crazy to imagine that HTR is probably the most important behavioral paradigm for psychedelics, maybe certainly in terms of ones that are specific to psychedelics, like maybe PPI or something is as important, but that's not only used in psychedelics.
Oh, yeah. And isn't that in drug discrimination or probably too, but drug discrimination is hard to do. It requires a lot of training and time, and there are difficulties with it that can be avoided with head twitch. So I think we're going to see much more shift towards head twitch. I mean, you pretty much have already seen that, in my opinion, in the literature. And it's just a lot more conducive to probing some of these pharmacological questions that people have. And, you know, the evidence is very strong that it's, you know, if you activate 2A receptors, you get this effect. And so, you know, you can use it then to study not only to predict if a new compound is going to be psychedelic or not, but to study how like other effects modulate the 2A receptor and how that might alter ultimately hallucinogenic effects in humans. But you can use the change in head twitch to get some prediction of what might happen in humans.
Right. And what I think is so crazy is this is like an immensely influential paper that a lot of people don't seem to be aware of. Like on Google Scholar, this must be some kind of mistake in indexing it, but it, according to Google Scholar, only has 38 citations. And the paper isn't even really about the HTR. They seem more interested in the permanent alteration aspect than about having, or I mean, that's like a major part of it. It's like they weren't looking for some kind of behavioral correlate.
No.
And I think that's also pretty wild how these scientists probably had no idea that that was, first of all, that it would be so important, but that that was the major takeaway from their research.
Yeah. No, I mean, the permanency is an interesting thing in and of itself. And they published like another paper earlier that year where they showed, you know, LSD given with indole caused like a permanent change in the behavior of guppies and some other fish. So that's where like the whole indole and permanent behavior change came from. But obviously, you know, from the sense that like back in the 50s and these drugs were kind of thought of as psychotomimetics, and, you know, they were looking for ways to study schizophrenia. And I think like that's sort of the takeaway and what they were really trying to emphasize, obviously, is that like a single exposure to this drug with indole causes a permanent behavior change. I mean, they don't really necessarily even they might mention psychosis, but they don't play it up as much as, you know, maybe they could have, which I guess is good. But but I mean, the other thing is I can't imagine that, one, because of all the interest in work like that, that other people haven't tried to replicate it. And I would be shocked if the CIA did not try to replicate this in humans. Like, I mean, it's sort of like exactly what they were looking for in MK Ultra, right? Like a way to like permanently induce psychosis, or one of the things also.
Right. Do you think that there's any way that the results that they reported could be replicated? It's, I mean, they describe months of alteration from this combination of indole and LSD.
So when I read this, like, you could never publish something like this in Science or any journal, honestly, today, because there's really no method section. They give some details, but like key details are missing. You know, they mention things like multiple mouse strains. Like, well, which, you know, matters. Where did they come from? I don't recall, but I don't think there's much. Oh no, intravenous administration. But you know, they don't mention like what vehicle it was in or where they obtained the drugs. You know, what salt form of LSD it was, like that matters. And that's actually a pretty high dose of LSD for head twitch. But again, it depends on the type of mouse. But then there were some other statements in this paper and the other one that make me a little concerned, like, you know, the effects lasted from 1 week to months from, you know, in 10 to 60% of the animals. Like, what? You know, like, that's a huge range. What does that even mean? Does it mean you replicated it several times and it was, like, highly variable every time? Like, that's concerning. You know, why not report a mean and the standard deviation or something? I don't even know what it means. And so I wouldn't be shocked if especially back then, people, you know, kind of doing like pilot exploratory work in the lab, maybe not being quite as stringent as you should be with like controlled experiments. And so I don't think that would explain everything, but my point is, I don't think you could replicate their work even if you wanted to. There's just not enough information in the paper and some of the implications of how variable all this seems anyway. I don't know.
Right. And the whole weirdness of the IV indole administration aside, are you aware of any subsequent research that shows permanent effects from psychedelics that are any kind of permanent HTR under any circumstances?
No. And in fact, there's another interesting thing is there's tolerance. Now, again, though, I don't know about the social isolation. So if that causes a sustained effect, that would suggest it is possible to induce without tolerance developing. But if you give a psychedelic repeatedly to a mouse, you'll attenuate the head twitch response. It develops tolerance to it. It's reversible. You know, after a week or two, it goes away. But no, I've never seen any evidence that it can be permanent. It'd be interesting to ask, you know, someone like Adam Halberstadt again, because he's, you know, done this like hundreds of times, if not thousands. But I know maybe like one or two mice, you know, went nuts after. I kind of doubt it, but and it'd be hard to say for sure, you know. Like,
well, and I remember Chuck Nichols. I don't know if he's published this yet, and if he hasn't, we can edit this out. But he was saying something about. He did experiments with repeated administration of LSD causing some kind of inflammatory syndrome that was similar, he felt, to schizophrenia in some way. Does that ring a bell?
I know his dad was doing that type of repeated LSD administration. I don't know if he did it in the inflammatory context, but I know he was using repeat LSD as a model of schizophrenia. I don't know if I ever saw it published, but I saw in some documentary that they were showing his lab and he was like talking about it with one of the graduate students or postdoc. So I know they had done that. I'm sure other people have as well. And I know even like MK-1 and PCP have been given chronically as a way to try to induce schizophrenia. I mean, I personally wouldn't buy those are reliable models whatsoever, but you know.
Right, yeah.
I'm sure you'll get data with them, but you'll get data with any model. You know, the question is what will it really tell you?
Right. And has anyone endeavored to explain why or what this might mean? Because of course, you know, the major problem with psychedelics is that if you're dealing with an animal that can't speak English, it's really impossible to know what it is they are experiencing. And the HTR is not something that occurs in humans. And does anyone know, other than it being serotonergically mediated in some way, what it is?
They're checking out the patterns on the cage. no one has any idea. And I think any attempt to even do it would show, you know, it just would be absurd, because we just don't know what it's like to be a mouse. I think that's a problem with, like, all, most of these psychiatry models of, you know, despair models of, you know, forced swim, where, but they're like anthropomorphizing and trying to, you know, say that they understand the mouse is in despair, but you can interpret it in the complete opposite context, right? Like there's a definite behavior, but you can interpret it in any way you want. You can just make up some explanation that sounds reasonable, and if you convince enough people, all of a sudden that's the, you know, golden hypothesis. I have not, and I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't buy any, like, psychological explanation, obviously. It clearly seems to be some type of reflex, I think, seems to be, I don't even know if that's the right word, but, you know, it's like this behavior that it can be induced by 2A activation. I mean, that's clear, you know, that you can use tons of 2A antagonists, and it prevents the head switch response and reduces it in a dose-dependent manner. The potency of the antagonist correlates with their potency to block the 2A receptor. If you knock 2A out, you don't get that response. So there's really good evidence if you activate 2A, you get the head twitch. But, you know, what it is, I don't know. I've heard things like it might have some relation to, like, the wet dog shakes. So, you know, it might just be kind of some almost reflex-like behavior that animals have that is mediated by serotonin in some region of the brain. It just so happens if you hit that button, they do that, which is great for us, but I think it's probably just some weird coincidence.
Right, and I think that's one of the interesting things about it, is it is kind of less anthropomorphic than, like, conditioned place preference or forced swim or something. Like, it's very abstract. There's nothing that you can point to and say, oh, yeah, that's like, that makes sense from a human perspective that your head would twitch when you took a psychedelic.
Yeah, no, exactly. So, like, models can have, you know, what they call, like, face validity. And I'm generalizing a little, but the idea is, like, how well does it mimic the sort of symptoms and features of the disease? And I think whenever we're trying to do that with animal models, especially when it's not, like, really clear cut, like scratching or something, it breaks down. And I like that about the head twitch, because there isn't any of that. The validity is construct, meaning it's able to be induced by a pharmacological effect that we understand, that is the same pharmacological effect necessary to induce hallucinogenic effects in humans. And the potency of the drugs in head twitch correlates with the potency in humans, and that's the predictive validity. So it has construct and predictive validity, which, in my opinion, are the most useful types for a model to have. You know, with face validity, it's just like an endless argument between experts of what it really means and what it is.
Right. Right, and these are, it's interesting because, of course, this isn't an issue in all of pharmacology. Like, I think most people would agree that if you want to test stimulants, it's very easy to just measure an increase in locomotor activity, or sedatives, a decrease, or, you know, anesthetics. But there's something very complicated about anything with antidepressants or psychedelics specifically, because they act on a type of unconsciousness, which we are not sure exists in non-human animals.
Yeah, right. I don't think we could use, I think it'd be very hard to use an animal model to study, like, the phenomenology of psychedelic effects. I guess somebody could try to make a strong case for, like, monkeys or something, or chimps. But even then, I think at that point, you should probably just use humans, unless there's some, like, really necessary thing that you could do. Because there's way, even with humans, there's so many assumptions that have to be made. when you want to study psychedelic effects. And even the way, you know, some, two people could have the exact same experience and explain it totally differently. You know, and so that is, you know, the issue of subjectivity and phenomenology, but that's a huge problem. I think the same is true of, you know, depression or these disease states. I mean, two patients could have the exact same experiences and just, you know, explain them differently. And so they get different rating scores on the tests, you know, for example. And so, the, you know, there are, I mean, psychiatry has many issues, but certainly, you know, one of them is the question of what these diagnoses even mean. I mean, when there's no biomarkers, no physiological explanation, no genetic explanation for most of these things, you have to start to wonder, are they real or are they just human constructs? And they don't even seem to have utility, not for drug discovery. I mean, most of the trials end up failing. And is it just because we're bad at making drugs and our models suck? I mean, I think our models suck, that's part of it, but maybe the models suck because we're not even modeling a real thing. I mean, we have no evidence to even suggest major depressive disorder is a single disorder that has a shared underlying pathophysiology. That's insane, you know? Like, I think, you know, and other people have said this as well, I think we'd get a lot further by targeting, like, core symptoms of these disorders rather than trying to treat the whole disorder, because we know that, you know, the symptoms are a little bit easier to make sense of and explain, and we can at least be reasonably confident, you know, that they're, they exist, at least, you know, but like, you know, like, you know, treating positive affect or mood or sleep issues. But with something like depression, I mean, two people diagnosed with depression, if you look at the way it's diagnosed, even, you only have to have a certain number of criteria out of a list. And so we could be both diagnosed, same exact score on the HAM-D or the MADRS, but have totally different symptom clusters. And to think that we would respond to the same drug in a trial, I mean, there's no reason to even assume that, in my opinion.
Going back to animals, I don't know how you'd begin to, like, do you have an idea about a better model? Or do you think that's just the whole idea is kind of a fool's errand?
I think we can do better. I think it needs a lot of input from a lot of different people. And I think one start would be, like I was kind of getting at, is if you targeted core features of the disorders, rather than saying somebody has to improve globally on this depression rating scale or on this anxiety rating scale or Alzheimer's rating scale, you targeted like core features of the disease, like the affect or motivation, you know, anhedonia. And then people might argue, like, well, then all the drugs are just symptomatic. But first of all, that's what most of our drugs are anyway in CNS space, and certainly in psychiatry. And if it helped people and led to more successful drug discovery, you know, what's the problem? I think, like, fundamentally some of these things are connected. Like, it's reasonable to think somebody's sleep problems affect their mood and their mood affects their sleep. But that doesn't mean that, you know, that you'll find a drug that's going to, like, across the board improve all these symptoms, especially when we have no evidence there's even a shared cause, and certainly not between different patients. So I think if you clustered people and did trials based on a core symptom, I just think discovery would be more efficient. In the process, we might end up finding drugs that did work more globally, even if, whether there's a true disorder or not, they'll just work across the board. And I kind of think psychedelics might be that drug. I think they target mood and affect, right? And so it's almost like they just make people feel better and have a more positive outlook. So no matter what your pain is, no matter what you're suffering, you know, any way someone else assesses that, those will improve, right? Because your outlook improves. You know, you feel better, you feel more motivated. So I kind of think psychedelics might be this weird exception that works within the system we have. I don't think, though, that's justification for keeping the system. I really think we need to carefully look at it and reevaluate. It's not working. I mean, look at all the companies just gutting their CNS discovery. Like, across the board, it's insane. You know, they're just sick of it. They've gotten nowhere. You know, the models are not reliable. And I think there's fundamental issues with the way the trials are done, the way the diagnoses are done. So it's an endless loop.
All these things deny any kind of psychological dimension to depression. Like, I remember I interviewed this anesthesiologist named Glenn Brooks, and I was asking him, like, oh, do you ever consider talk therapy in conjunction with ketamine? And he's like, no, this is a purely biochemical effect, nothing to do with their psychology. And I, on one hand, admire that kind of staunch reductionism. But if when I think about my own experiences taking something like ketamine, I think the major therapeutic effect comes from actually becoming slightly delusional in my thinking for a little while, where I get out of a rut of like, nothing good is going to happen. Like, my options are limited. Things aren't going to get better. I can't do this thing that I want to do. And then for 1 hour, you have a sort of grandiosity and a increased aperture of possibility, where all these things that previously seemed impossible seem not only possible, but just like, why not? Why not do whatever? Anything, all these things that you dismiss as like, for whatever number of reasons, suddenly seem like, oh, sure, whatever. I could be a politician. I could be an actor. I could be a musician. I could do whatever I want. It's all possible if I try. And like, how do you model something like that? There's such nuanced psychological changes that at least for me, I don't know about other people.
No, I think definitely. I mean, when I see people try to argue that, like, even with a dissociative, that you know, you get rid of the dissociative effect. Even though they say the doses used with ketamine aren't like hallucinogenic, and that's true, but they are intoxicating. I mean, it's like alcohol, but there are still psychological effects. I think, and definitely with psilocybin, those are important. And the people saying they're not, I guarantee they have not had those experiences. Because not to say that like having it just should make you an expert or anything, huh. I think they've done trial after trial and asked people, drug naive people, you know, what is this experience? How meaningful was it? You know, top five most meaningful experience of your life. Come on, how are you going to dismiss that as not being clinically important to someone's mental health or outcomes? Give me a break. Without question, anyone who has these experiences, you ask, I reflected on my life. I saw myself through someone else's lens. Like, there's no way the experience doesn't have an influence. Is it everything? Probably not. Could we maybe make drugs that don't have those effects that still have the same outcomes? I kind of doubt it. I think they could still have some efficacy and maybe be better than our other existing treatments. But I think if you really want to maximize the clinical efficacy with these things, the experience is going to have to be a part of it. It's going to be a challenge, I think, potentially to maximize it and sort of, you know, control it. And you know, I think it is, you know, these aren't magic bullets. You're going to need to, you know, have psychotherapy and eat well and exercise well. I mean, that's my opinion. I think the drugs can kind of reset you, give you a new outlook, improve your kind of overall mood and perspective. And then if somebody can encourage you and direct you into the right path, it will sustain itself. And there is, I mean, you know, there's still a physiological effect. I've talked about this with Adam again, and, you know, he makes a great point that you can't necessarily even separate the psychological, like the psychological is going to have a physiological basis. So, you know, they are almost certainly intertwined.
Right. Certainly in humans. And then I guess this all comes back to rodents, because there's some question about what kind of psychological experience is even occurring.
Yeah. I mean, it's just so hard to say, and I don't know that we'll ever really be able to, right? Like, we don't have like a consciousness detector or an experience detector. I can't get inside your mind, let alone the mind of a mouse. And it might not even make sense for us to, like, even if I could see a video of what they're experiencing, how would that tell me much of anything, right? I mean, maybe I could kind of see what they're seeing, but not really, because I'd still be seeing it through my own brain. You know, I'd be interpreting the shapes and the colors in my own way. So it wouldn't even make sense to do that. You know, you'd have to become a mouse to know what they're experiencing. And maybe there aren't, I'm not saying there aren't any features of a mouse that might not share some physiological basis in what we call, you know, depression, at least for some people, for example. But we can't even identify those things in people. There is no good hypothesis to explain the etiology or pathogenesis of depression in humans. Now, you're going to try to use like a mouse swimming in a you know, graduated cylinder to figure out the pharmacology? Like, what? Like, no wonder we're not getting anywhere.
We've both watched rodents being administered various types of psychedelics or dissociatives. Do you get the impression that they enjoy the effect? Of course, you can't tell, but they don't self-administer them.
They don't, you say? Or they will?
They don't, right?
I think dissociatives, it depends. My understanding is I think under some conditions they will, although I don't know that they always do. Psychedelics, I don't think they generally do, at least not rodents. So, yeah, I mean, which would suggest they don't like it is what I would guess, because, I mean, at least this is anthropomorphizing, but I think it's reasonable to think, you know, if an animal enjoys something, it's going to seek it out. That's like basic behavioral, you know, behaviorism. So I think that's like a, if not absolute truth, it's a reasonable thing to assume. So, no, they might not like the experience. I don't know. And maybe they don't like it because they're in a freaking cage and being dumped in, you know, a bucket of water. I don't know. Or just worried about what this big thing in a white coat is going to do to me next. You know, it's not the best setting, I'll say, for the mouse.
Yeah, definitely not. You know, because the doses that are used for HDR, I guess they're pretty high. Like with something like DPT, I think the standard is 3 mg/kg.
Well, I mean, it's very hard to compare. I mean, across the board, mice can take doses of drugs that, like, no human could take the equivalent by weight of. You know, they have hyperactive metabolic activity, and there are some differences in kinetics. Though my understanding is that kinetics is the big one. It's a little bit hard to compare, like, in the sense of you can't just, like, scale up the dose. There are actually conversion factors. Off the top of my head, I don't remember what it is for mice, and I don't know if it's, like, greater than average with psychedelics, but...
Yeah, I don't know about psychedelics in particular, or if anyone has investigated that, but I know that there's a conversion factor that's used as a rule of thumb in human equivalent doses, and it's like you divide the mouse dose by 12.3. So the human equivalent dose for a 60-kilogram person who's getting 3 mg/kg, or for a mouse that's getting 3 mg/kg of DPT, would only be about 15 milligrams. So you're right. It's not actually all that high of a dose.
Mice can take, you know, by weight doses that, you know, humans would not be able to handle any drugs, pretty much.
And it's also, I guess, just back to this final, back to this paper. It's too bad both the authors are dead, because they were both microbiologists. They did these two influential papers. Actually, really only one of them is influential, but they did these two papers on permanent alteration induced by LSD in guppies and in mice, and then never did anything else in this domain again. And I wonder if they even knew. I wonder if it's one of those things like that guy that co-authored the early ketamine paper with Calvin Stevens, who'd never heard of ketamine, if they'd like even realize how influential this was.
That is wild. Yeah, you don't know. I guess they worked at Merck. I saw Merck, yeah. And they actually mentioned another scientist, don't have his name in front of me, who they said told them about the head twitch response.
Yes, that is very true. Here we are talking about the history of HTR, the first HTR publication by Doris Keller and Wayne Umbright, and we are neglecting to even mention the fact that the effect was first observed by a biochemist named Dilworth Wayne Woolley, who has received absolutely no credit for this whatsoever. His Wikipedia entry doesn't say anything at all about him having discovered the HCR, being the first person to have observed it, which is especially impressive because I am under the impression that he was blind. So shout out to that guy. Amazing man.
And that guy did another study where he gave LSD. I guess it was like a rope climbing assay. I don't know if it had been used prior to that. I mean, I've heard of a rope climbing assay. I wonder what happened to them and if they were aware of the impact. I don't know. You know, I don't know the whole history of the head twitch as well. I do know Glenn, you know, did a lot of work with it. I think some people had done some things in rats as well prior to Glenn doing work with like a bunch of phenethylamines. And then, you know, there were definitely a number of other labs using it up until, you know, the current times. And I mean, it continues to be refined. Like Adam has done a lot of really cool work and some other people have as well, automating it and making it high throughput. You know, he like implants a magnet in the head of the animals and uses essentially like generated currents in wires wrapped around the cage to detect a signal. And he just published a paper using a neural network to sort of analyze the data, because before a human would still have to like look at patterns, you know, the maps, spectrums, but now it's fully automated. And so that, you know, that's really cool. Just because you can get more data and it's a more automated process. Cause anytime, you know, labs where there are people rating it, you know, not that people can't be trained, but I just think there's so much subjectivity when it's like a student who was just trained doing it. I see this because I work in labs. You know, often it's like an undergraduate or a new graduate student who gets that kind of job, and you know, they're just like trained and go have at it.
Right. Yeah, it's always good to automate that sort of thing whenever possible. I was even reading this really interesting thing where the HTR can be elicited by a CB1 inverse agonist, which superficially seemed like an exception to this idea that the HCR is purely elicited via a serotonergic mechanism. But then what they actually found was that by blocking the CB1 receptor, that there was a release of serotonin that was then activating these 5-HT2A pathways. So if they co-administered a 5-HT2A antagonist with the CB1 antagonist, that HTR would be blocked.
Rimonabant causes the effect in a 2A dependent manner. And other, like CB1 agonists, actually attenuate the effect with psychedelics. So they inhibit it, which is kind of not what you would expect in the sense, like, I know humans, if they use cannabis on psychedelics, it is definitely not attenuating. You know, it's, I don't know that it's potentiating per se, but it's creating a quite intense experience.
And that's certainly the reputation that it has in terms of the kind of folk pharmacology, that if you smoke cannabis at the tail end of an experience, it will regenerate the experience. And whether that's just them getting stoned on top of the mild residual effect of the psychedelic, or if there actually is some kind of direct potentiation, is probably a more difficult question to answer.
Definitely. But it does seem to, like, it doesn't seem to block the effect, I guess. So morphine also and buprenorphine, fentanyl, decrease the head twitch response to psychedelics. 1A agonists, like buspirone, decrease it. And interestingly, also decrease the effect of psilocybin in humans. 2C agonists are a little more complicated. They seem to decrease it as well. And there's actually, I don't know if you know this, but in at least in some mice strains, the head twitch is biphasic. And so it's dose dependent. It increases like a bell-shaped curve. it reaches a maximum and then it drops off again back to baseline. And some people have suggested that the ascending arm, the increase, is 2A mediated, but the descending, decreasing side is 2C mediated. But interestingly, Adams looked at selective 2A agonists, and we recently made one that's pretty selective and over 2C, and it also shows the biphasic effect, so that doesn't really make sense.
And when you say biphasic, you mean?
A bell-shaped curve. So it dose-dependently increases the number of head twitch counts. Like, that's how it's quantified, the number of twitches in 10 or 30 minutes. So you give a milligram, you get like 10. You give 20 milligrams, you get, say, 100 twitches. And then if you give double the dose, 20 milligrams, then it starts to decline again. You get 50 twitches. And then if you give 200 milligrams, say, it goes back to baseline. So the number of twitches is kind of how you dose-dependently quantify it over time. So the twitches over time. And if you increase the dose, it reaches a maximum number of twitches per time, and then it starts to decrease again.
It starts to decrease over as the effect of
twitch, the number of twitches over time decrease.
Right.
They reach a peak, and then instead of just like, you know, saying, say that the 10 milligrams LSD causes 100 twitches. If you give then, I keep forgetting the dose I'm saying. So if you give 10 milligrams of LSD, which would be a very high dose, but and it causes 100 twitches, say that's the maximum number of twitches you can get. If you then give 20 milligrams, it will start to decrease again. It doesn't go back. It doesn't like stay at 100 or go up higher. It reaches a maximum and then it drops off.
Huh.
So the curve, the dose response curve, looks like a bell.
That's interesting.
Yes, and some labs haven't seen it in certain strains, but the problem is, too, it might just be the dose response is shifted and they're not giving a high enough dose, for example.
Is there some other behavioral effect at these very high doses that would account for that, like a kind of global motor dysfunction of some kind?
It does not seem to be. No, it seems to be there's some potential pharmacological effect, is at least my understanding of it.
Huh. And so if you were to extrapolate that to humans, would the suggestion be that extremely high doses of psychedelics would somehow be?
No. Yeah. Well, yeah, if you died, I guess you would stop tripping. No, I don't think you can. I don't think the head twitch is going to be a perfect model. Like what I think is it's useful to us. It will bring us to a point. At some point, the effects that are causing the effects in humans will differ from what's happening in the animals. That's my opinion. Like, you know, right now we don't really know, you know, in what brain regions are responsible for the effects of head twitch in mice, let alone the psychedelic effects in humans. And, you know, even then, in humans, there might be like multiple things that are happening that are 2A mediated, causing the, you know, tactile effects, the visual effects, the thought effects, you know, different brain regions and things. With head twitch, it might be a more simple kind of, you stimulate it in this region on this type of cells and it does this. But, you know, we don't know that yet. There's research on it, but it's not conclusive. So I think at some point the construct validity again will break down, but it can get us to that point. I think even the predictive value might break down at some point, because right now all the, you know, if you talk about like bias signaling, so LSD, you know, we say is a serotonin 2A agonist, it activates the 2A receptor, but it's kind of misleading to say that, because a drug can activate the receptor in different ways. And two commonly studied ways are for 2A, G protein pathways called GQ pathways and beta arrestin pathways. So when you take LSD, it binds to your 2A receptors and it can then activate both the G proteins and the arrestins inside your cells. At this point, we don't really know which of those is necessary for the head twitch, although we have some evidence, we're going to be publishing on that somewhat soon, and others have as well, then we also don't know in humans which of those pathways is mediating the psychedelic effects. And again, it might differ depending on what effect you're talking about. So it's in theory possible to develop a psychedelic that was a false negative in the head twitch one day. Currently, our compounds, we don't have biased compounds, meaning, you know, of our compounds activate the pathways we know about. Like, there's some that are claim bias, but people can't replicate it. Or, you know, the bias is not that great. So, you know, people might act like it's greater than it is. But the point is, almost all of our current drugs activate both of those pathways. So we don't have any that are selective enough to figure out which is necessary for the effect in the head twitch and which is necessary for the effect in humans. It might differ. Our current evidence suggests it doesn't, at least at this point. But we're only looking at two pathways. There are, you know, potentially hundreds. I doubt there's that many, but there's probably, you know, 10 or more signaling pathways, especially when you start talking about different cells and different areas of the brain. The CNS is, the complexity of it, I don't think most people even understand how complex it is. I mean, it's one reason why it literally remains a black box. We don't know shit about the nervous system. Most drugs we have, think about, like, even psychedelics, we spent decades studying. The best we can really say is, oh, well, they activate this receptor and then magic happens. You trip. You know, again, I mean, you know, I'm being a little bit absurd, but, you know, we can say maybe they increase glutamate and that might, you know, be responsible. But, you know, even with that type of stuff, we don't really know. We haven't done extensive work yet to figure it out.
Right. And you mentioned the possibility of developing a compound that would be a false negative for HTR. I know that there's a number of false positives, even I think para-hydroxyamphetamine and yohimbine, arguably, and there's a few others. Are there no negatives, drugs that are known to be serotonergic psychedelics in humans that do not produce the HTR in rodents?
So there have been a few labs that have claimed the compound did not, but then other labs have found that they did. If you look at the study that I was on, this with Adam, where, you know, he looked at, I don't know, something like over 20 compounds from all different classes, all of them showed activity that correlated very well with their potency in humans. I think for sure there could be false negatives. And I could make one if you gave me enough money. You know, I would just find an enzyme in mice that's different than humans and design the drug to be chewed up in the mice so it would never get to the brain, for example. So, you know, you could do it, and I think they can exist, but it's overall those would be exceptions. And even the interesting thing is, you know, the false positives, which you bring up, which is an important point. The interesting thing about those is it depends how you define a false positive, because in the sense of, you know, is that drug psychedelic? Yes, it's a false positive. But in the sense of, does it activate 2A? It seems like it's not a false positive, meaning, you know, it's these drugs are increasing serotonin indirectly, and that's activating 2A, which causes this response. And I would argue then, they might actually be hallucinogenic. Like serotonin syndrome involves hallucinations. It might even have certain psychedelic effects. It's just that there's so many other horrible effects laid on top of it that you're not going to experience those aspects. Right? Like, you're still activating 2A, so you're getting that effect, but you're also activating, you know, 1A, 2B, 2C, 5HT, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
Right, right. That's a very good point.
Adrenergic receptors, right? It's a shit show. It's a mess. So in that sense, it seems like all the drugs that cause head twitch that I've seen, at least like followed up on, they all do it in a 2A dependent manner, which is actually, I mean, very surprising to me, that it's that robust and sensitive. and reliable.
And there were many other ones tested, and it almost seems like you could imagine some alternate scientific history where those other models were used. I mean, at the same time, you had people noting LSD-induced forepaw treading in rodents, or piloerection in cats, or even more unusual things like penguin-like posture in newly hatched chicks exposed to 2CB, or limb jerks in stump-tail macaques. But none of those caught on.
Yeah, and I used to be quite a skeptic. I'm pretty skeptical of things. And I don't want to imply the model's perfect. Again, I do think there are, of course, limitations. There always are. You're insane if you don't think that. But it's one of the best that I have seen in my experience. I was skeptical. I also would just be very skeptical that 2A would explain the major psychedelic effects or all of them. And I'm pretty much convinced now that it's, I'm sure there's other factors, but it's like the bread and meat of the sandwich, so to speak. But Hedgewitch has really shown itself. I mean, not only to explain, I mean, again, the paper that I was on, that Adam just published, it really speaks for itself. The potency in Hedgewitch not only correlates with drug discrimination in animals, but the potency in humans as well, across lysergamides, psychedelic phenethylamines, psychedelic amphetamines, and tryptamines. So it's quite impressive. Now, the next step is to expand that, and then try to use the linear regression model developed to predict the potency of new compounds. So we're definitely looking into that, working on it. But even, this paper, and you're on this paper with the N-benzyls, but we did some really cool stuff with the head twitch response. And to me, we're even going to, sort of get at explaining why drugs like glycerides, a good example of a drug.
Right, right.
That even in drug discrimination, it's a false positive. Right? It doesn't cause hallucinogenic effects in humans, but rats think it's LSD, or at least like partially. But it's not active in head twitch, at least, by a number of labs. I'm not going to get into it now. You have to wait for the paper, but I think we can explain that, which is really neat, with a much simpler way. Other people have tried, but I think, if you go off Occam's razor, ours is, really simple and elegant. So.
Right, right. Yeah. Glyceride is kind of, I think, one of the most frequently discussed examples of a sort of false positive.
Yes, in drug discrimination. Yeah. But head twitch is at least typically able to distinguish it. I think that, the other thing is, I don't think it depends on the species of mice you're using, your technique. I mean, there are so many factors. So, that's another thing to kind of consider. And there are instances, like another example of a potential false negative, although I don't really know that it is, but you'd say like something like LSM, 775, where it didn't induce head twitch on its own unless you block 1A receptors.
That's interesting.
And, but it's also not very hallucinogenic relative to its binding affinity. So I think that's consistent with its effects in humans. It has a little bit of an effect, but not much. And so it'll be interesting if a human took it with, a 1A antagonist like Pindolol, would it become, I guess, potent as LSD, for example, or fully active anyway.
Right. I mean, that's a really important point, is that even in humans, there's a liminal space where people aren't totally sure if something is psychedelic or not. LSM would be a good example. A lot of these butyltryptamines, there seems to be some kind of disagreement whether they're sedatives or mild psychedelics. I mean, at some point, it's hard to tell for anyone.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I even think, imagine if you were like completely blinded to a drug, especially at lower doses, like if you were trying to evaluate a drug, I could see even cannabinoids kind of, especially if you were kind of expecting a psychedelic, again, at lower doses, I think you might be able to convince yourself it was a psychedelic. Higher doses, probably not. But then again, I don't even, I mean, it'd be interesting to kind of probe some of those questions. I think people are a lot more confident than they should be about their ability to distinguish drugs. Like if they were in double blind conditions, I think it's a lot harder than everyone wants to think it would be.
Oh yeah. I mean, there was that paper that came out of Johns Hopkins in 2017 that was co-authored by Roland Griffiths, and they had 20 participants who all had extensive experience with classical psychedelics and dissociatives. For classical psychedelics, the mean was at least 60 experiences. And some of these people, I think it had over 100 experiences with psychedelics. And when they were given a 400 milligram dose of DXM, keep in mind these people were not dissociative naive, still only 60% of participants recognized that it was a dissociative at all. And 10% of them thought it was a classical psychedelic. So I think it's pretty damn clear that people overestimate their ability to discriminate these sorts of things. This is why I always think it's so absurd when people tell me that they can, you know, experientially detect minute enantiomeric differences in the substances they consume. When you have very experienced participants in a blinded study who can't even tell you the basic pharmacological class of the drug that they're consuming.
Yeah. So, I mean, I do think there are like parallels, dose dependent, and I'm sure there are people trained that could distinguish it. But, you know, I definitely think a lot of people can be fooled. Definitely. I mean, look, even that study with the placebo, which was so interesting. You remember it was recently there was a study where they gave a placebo and a lot of people had a psychedelic experience.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I remember when I was in middle school and there was something called Boston Hemp Fest, and they would openly sell melatonin tablets as psychedelics. And because it was melatonin, they would even sell it to basically children like myself. And I remember everyone around me, all of my friends, we were all kind of saying, you know, is this melatonin psychedelic? I think it is.
Yeah, no. I mean, again, especially when it's, you know, like it's a mild kind of state. That I think you really can't be confident. Like, unless you're really seeing patterns in the walls, you know, it could be placebo. I mean, definitely. Which is amazing. Especially if you've had those experiences, I think you can kind of get into that state on your own. Yeah, a milder version. Like, I want to emphasize that. I don't think you can have like a +3 experience.
Right.
I'd be surprised, I guess.
And do you have any final thoughts on the original 1956 paper on the HTR?
I mean, I think it'd be very interesting to try to replicate it. I don't, you know, and I was trying to like come up with, you know, even absurd explanations of what happened. And this is absolutely not true, but I think this is a kind of interesting idea. So hear me out. So LSD binds to the 2A receptor. Indol acts as an allosteric modulator that traps LSD in the 2A receptor and also prevents it from being downregulated. So the receptor is now in the membrane, fully active with LSD bound, and it can't come off. So these people are, the mice are permanently getting 2A activation signal. Solved.
There you go. I mean, yeah, of course, these simple compounds, like there's, you know, an aryl hydrocarbon receptor, like it's not out of the question that they could do something. I just
Well, remember, I don't know if you know, like the early models of trying to explain the SAR of psychedelics, the phenethylamines, they would like constrict the side chain into like an indolic like conformation, which I mean is absurd. You know, the energy required to constrain it—it's just be so great.
Right.
But they thought that was the active pose or something.
Right.
And it's interesting because you can even like you know they explained it. I think like that's why the, you know, 2,5-dimethoxy pattern is best because it's not blocking the nitrogen, and like it's just funny when, you know, even being like incorrect. And we're always incorrect, but like definitely incorrect. You can come up with these like explanations. You can cherry pick things that fit, and like everything can be presented that way. I think people really need to remember that. You can make anything sound good. And also, you can make any result you want. Like, if you tell me what you want your experiment to show, I can design an experiment to show you that. I might have to optimize for the results you want, but I can do it. And so many people do that all the time, thinking that that's science. You know, they optimize the experiment till they get the result. It's their hypothesis. Then they publish it like it's a huge discovery. And it's just, I mean, come on.
Right. I mean, even Bufotini and, you know, people saying that it was too polar to enter the brain. And of course, it is more polar. So you can point to that and say, look, it's so much more polar than psilocin. That's why. But
oh, yeah. Yeah. For decades. I mean, great scientists I respect thought it was inactive and built up models to explain why psilocin was and this one wasn't. And I mean, and, you know, there might be some truth to what they're saying, but the fundamental assumption, which was treated as like an axiom, was that Bufotini was inactive, and it is certainly not inactive. That story is an interesting one. I think that would be worth probing more, is how that even kind of happened, that people came to be so confident that it was inactive.
It's weird. I mean, it's almost like chloroquine or something, where it became sort of politicized. Like, I don't know if you've seen that argument between Jonathan Ott and Thomas Lytle that was published in the Journal of Psychedelic Drugs, but it was like, it was getting into like almost personal territory between the two of them. And it's, you know, this is in the realm of pharmacological mysteries, this is not an especially difficult one to solve. All it took was someone to try it, and the entire debate was over.
Yeah. It's very, very strange. And I mean, even just that everyone acted like Andernanthra seeds could be explained by their DMT content. There's almost no DMT in most samples. It's almost exclusively Bufotini. And so that, too, would have been a major issue with that, you know, the claim that it's inactive. I mean, then how do you explain the potent psychedelic effect of, you know, this seed that pretty much contains Bufotini as the major possible contributor to the effects?
Yeah, no, it messes everything up. It like has major implications for archaeology. It's you know, these little things can totally change the interpretation of some kind of discovery of bones in a ancient settlement.
Yeah.
Like there was a paper published pretty recently where they'd found all of these toad bones in some kind of South American midden pile or something, and they were saying that they thought that it was from a bufotenine containing species, but they couldn't make any claims about whether it was being used for drug purposes because people weren't certain whether or not bufotenine was active.
Yeah, you know, I have still seen in recent papers people claiming that there's still some question about it. Which, I mean, I guess if you're not like super familiar with, but at this point, like hundreds of people have tried it without question, and it's active, you know, like it's not even a question anymore. And if you're going to claim that, like, you know, maybe you can try it or ask someone at least, like, I don't know. Especially if like your hypotheses kind of depend on it, it's a risky proposition to take. You know, I could see if, like, you maybe you want to be skeptical of just, like, the one study by Ott, which was impressively done and beautiful. But, you know, you say, okay, that's an N of one. And, you know, I don't know, maybe it was contaminated, but, he analyzed it and everything. But at this point, so many people have tried it that it's, like, without question active. And, you know, and other differences and things, sure, there are with a lot of things, but...
Yeah. Okay, that's awesome. I think that's a great analysis of this paper.
Cool. Yeah, I hope it's replicated. We should try to convince Adam to.
That would be really cool.
Yeah. I think he'd be down. We'll see.
Certainly not all that difficult.
Yeah, and I mean, it has historical relevance, but I think even, you know, just as... to explain, like, if it is replicated, to understand how it's happening, definitely has pharmacological relevance and possibly clinical relevance.